Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Woof, 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 woof. So, yes. So today it is so perfect as Mercury stations to go direct and forward, having been retrograde, reminding us to remember all that we've forgotten. So perfectly, we re-welcome Greg Sarris, chairman of the Federated Indians of Groton Rancheria and board chair for Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. You've been busy, all right, always restoring the landscape. His most recent work, The Forgetters, told in the classic style of Southern Pomo and Coast Miwok creation stories. Yes, we want to start with that because you can feel it right away. It's a story cycle about the people who have forgotten their roots and consequently hurt the earth and each other. It's everywhere, masterfully infusing magical realism with the history of indigenous lands. Sarris encourages readers to remember our shared lineage and honor our interconnectedness with the environment. He's the award-winning author of innumerable books, including Grand Avenue, which was adopted into an HBO film, co-authored the Groton Rancheria Restoration Act, which restored federal recognition to the coastal Miwok and Southern Pomo Native Americans of California. And we met on November 12, 2001, via Joy Harjo and Jane and Mark Shabatari. Welcome, Greg.
Carolyn, it's so wonderful to reconnect with you. Wow. Thanks. This is great. Thank you. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for caring.
Oh, so much. And it is so perfect. I mean, we are in a resonant field of synchronicity. How reassuring. We'll bring in many weavings of context. But I love the last time I saw Jane and Mark. Hi there. I introduced them to a wonderful friend, my host, Kathy. And Mark said, "Are you a writer, too?" And Kathy said, "No." And he goes, "Why not?" Anyway, I love that. why are you not?
Yeah. So, yes, what's wrong with you?
So here we are. Well, yeah. No, just why not? Woof, woof, want to play.
Yeah.
And so here we are, you know, two water dragons in a dragon year of necessary miracles. And Mercury goes forward today, so it's even more. I mean, I know your book came out a couple of weeks ago, but this is really, it's like, woo. So, yeah, the themes, what have we forgotten?
You know, it's so strange, Caroline. I woke up this morning and I felt so, you know, as writers, we often worry and wonder about our work or if it's any good or if it's going to work or anybody's going to read it. And I woke up this morning and I just felt, wow, I'm doing the right thing. keep writing books. I felt really good. So
you are embraced by the whole. Now I just want to bring in just a little more because I can't help myself. So Mercury, the messenger, what to be a voice for, right? It's very all of us. It's very you, you know, to be a voice on behalf of the unified community of all beings. I just lit some Umpepu from the Sangomas of South Africa, which he said, if you're talking to medicine people, you can use this because it opens the channels to the ancestors and not just the human ancestors. There we go. So, yes, no, the auguries are good. And I'll come back to it just a little more of the astro mytho that is completely supporting you. But I have our notes from when we met on, twice, you know, at least, and then dinner and all kinds of fun things. But is it okay? Are you moved to tell the story of your moving into your home and your quadricep was ripped, and the bobcat?
Wow,
was
you,
helpful to you.
I saw your notes, Carolyn. That's amazing that you remember that. And I often tell that story. So yeah, I'd be happy to tell it again because I think in many ways it the story is illustrative of so much of how we live and how I think, I don't think, but how I rather would say how I know things. So what happened was that I had moved into my house And up here on the mountain, I grew up here in Sonoma County. I was born and raised here, didn't leave here till I was like 19 years old. And moved away. Of course, I would always come home and see my folks. And I was, as time went on and I was writing books and got, you know, with teaching at the UCLA and all that, I got involved in helping the tribe, all of my dad's people, my relatives here, get our restoration back, get restored as a federally recognized tribe. We were illegally terminated in 1966. So I got more and more involved. We were restored, and I needed to come home and move back to the land. And that was itself very fortuitous and interesting. I ended up on Sonoma Mountain, which is the site of where we believe that Coyote created the earth and all beings. So I end up home on a very sacred place, area. And at the time Coyote created the earth, at that time, it was a sacred ancient time when all the animals were still people. And of course, there's a story about how what happened to bring us to the world as we know it. But in any event, I'm back up here. And I was walking down my walkway, gravel walkway, and I slipped and ripped my quadricep. I could not walk. I could not, move. I had to have major surgery. They had to make a ramp for a wheelchair just to get me up the steps to the house. And of course, I thought it was a pretty dismal time. But I saw a bobcat come to the front door. And I thought, oh, well, what's this? I mean, up here there's a lot of wonderful, I don't want to say wildlife, I want to say a lot of relatives. And one was this bobcat that was coming around. And I noticed that that it had left in the night. I would find in the morning the rabbit livers and other kinds of animal entrails that are, I guess, the delicacy for, as they were for my people, when we would eat an animal. And so it was bringing me the most sacred and delicious part of its kill, rabbit livers and other things. And I thought, why is it doing this? What's it doing? And of course, Carol and I'm embarrassed to say, I would think to myself, here I am crippled and I have to clean up this mess, right? Mm. And so anyway, let's go forward a couple months, and I'm walking around and starting to walk around, and I go back to the gym where I'd been going here in town. And in the gym there's that I go to, it's a typical 24-hour fitness, and there are a lot of Latinos and different folks that go to this gym. And so it was, I don't recall if it was the first night I was back in the gym, but one of the earlier nights I was back in the gym. And by the way, I was so obsessive, I was going to the gym and I was still on crutches. But I was going out to my car after the gym, and it was night and dark. And this tall Mexican man, who I didn't know well, I mean, I just would nod hello to him in the gym over the last, you know, 3 or 4 months since I'd moved back and started going to the gym. I didn't really ever stop to talk to him. And I noticed that he was following me out to the car. And Carolyn, of course, I had that impulse of, uh-oh, I'm on crutches. What does he want? What is this? I kind of, a lot of the stereotypical stuff went through my mind. What's going on here? And I got to my car and I turned around, and he was standing about 5 feet away facing me, a tall guy, pretty tall guy, nearly 6 feet, with indigenous type features, as a lot of us Latino and different folks have. And I didn't know what to say. I kind of was tongue-tied, and he just looked at me and he said, I've been watching you and taking care of you for the last couple months, but you don't need me anymore. I'm good, and I'm going to leave now. And I, I never saw the guy in the gym after that. All right.
The guy was Bob? Okay.
Yes, it was. I'm sure you were sure it was the bobcat. I didn't see the bobcat nor him after that. And, people, I would tell friends, and they say, oh, that's crazy, or it's a coincidence or something like that. But of course, as you know, a lot of my ancestors said, we have this. Many of the folks have, we had were able to shape shift and do a lot of those types of things. In fact, I knew of people that could do that when I was a young kid. I guess I would just leave it with what Mabel McKay, the medicine woman, always said to me when, you know, she'd say, whether you believe it or not, it's true. So that was her great disclaimer, which I'm left with no other words but hers in this case.
That's great. There's 10,000 things to what you say, but I was trying to remember the name Mabel McKay because she's, I guess I've read so many things as well as the important book, The Forgetters, but you said that she would only make, what was she making, a basket?
A basket maker.
She would only make a basket for someone once she dreamed of them.
Yeah, you know, the Pomo, of course, I'm being a little ethnocentric here, tribal-centric, but the Pomo are considered among the best, if not the best, basket makers, and she wove miniatures, and she has baskets in the Smithsonian and so forth. And people would come and want order baskets and pay her quite a bit of money. But she would never compromise. They couldn't pay her money. She wouldn't take the money. She continued to work at an apple cannery for 20 years while she was making baskets that ended up in the Smithsonian. And she just would have the person sign their name in a book she had, and at night she'd run her fingers over the names. And unless she had the dream for the person in the basket, she wouldn't weave. And you know, she the baskets in which her art was ceremonially connected, obviously, to the person she was making the basket for.
Right. Well, when you told me the story of the quadriceps on Labor Day being ripped and the bobcat depositing kill and tasty bits like liver and whatever it is, kidneys, you know, at your doorstep, you know, at that time you had distilled it so that you understood, you know, and there's Sonoma Mountain where coyote created everything, and bobcat is always thought of as the feline coyote trickster. We love that.
Yeah.
And in your mind, the way you told it back in 2001 is that you could see through, or we can do it now, see through the bobcat's eyes, going, ah, this poor human can't hunt at all. You know, let me help him out, right? It was an affirmation.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yes. Yes.
Well, no, just that it was such an affirmation that, you know, you're home now. You're home now on top of Sonoma Mountain, right?
Yes, and that I would be cared for, or that I was seen and cared for. And subsequent to that, of course, as I began to drive around and do errands and go from here to there, the landscape itself, Caroline, became alive. And it was like the landscape and the place remembered me. And stories just emerged. I mean, stories just came from the landscape as I drove. And memory and so many things that I had been told as a young person. And, you know, everything just came alive. And since that time, I have up here on the mountain, I'm just... It's unbelievable the life that's here. I have buzzards that nest right in the tree outside my window, and I watch them grow. I mean, every season, and hummingbirds and rattlesnakes and bobcats and coyotes and mountain lions. New Year's Eve, I was down at the casino resort that the tribe has, and I got a note from my security that says, with a picture of a large, large male mountain lion just walking around my front gate, I guess welcoming the new year. I don't know what he was up to, or I'm not sure. But they're here. And, you know, we always used to say, well, we still say, I still say, that all the plants and animals, if you forget them, they will forget you. If you remember them, they'll remember you. So I think so much of what I've done here and my message going forward and the message of this book is that we must remember. And I think, yeah. Caroline, as we look around at the world today, I think it's a madness of insecurity, of homelessness, of restlessness. How do we come home again? How do we become one with place so that we not only see it, but we can be responsible for it? So I think, as you mentioned at the top of the show, being a messenger, so often I thought of my earlier work that was more about, oh, the social traumas and stuff, which is pretty popular in a lot of the ethnic and diverse literatures today. But we have to go forward. We have to be careful that our trauma and our need to articulate ourselves doesn't simultaneously create a silo that separates us from all of life. We really need the stories that reconnect us and show our connections, despite our pain, despite our differences, despite our histories of trauma, and so forth. So, I don't know, I just feel very compelled, and again, in alignment with all that you've said and where we are astrologically, as you mentioned, wow, it's all happening.
It is all happening, and it's so heartening that way. I love the way I was taught that mountain lion leads but needs no followers. So somebody gave me a mountain lion totem 20 years ago, and I go, leads but needs no followers. I always loved that. And so we're welcoming coyote and bobcat and mountain lion and all of our kin, you know, and as I, you know, and right now, straight above us in the Bay Area, I mean, I'm outside D.C., but I'm imaginatively with everybody there in the Bay Area, straight up is Jupiter and Uranus together at 22 degrees of Taurus. Earth, Jupiter, the intelligence of stories and travel and blessing and protection and luck will unfurl all of those. And Uranus, the trickster, the coyote, the raven, the crow, the bobcat, the against all odds ingenuity, you know, that says what you're doing. It's giving you a big affirmation. It's dropping, you know, delicacies at your doorstep, going, well done, lad. You've been very busy. We want to go back over many, many things to go forward. But the image for Jupiter and Uranus, each degree has a metaphor, is the Pleiades, Persephone, the ability of love to beget infinitely more love. Go, right. And it's in Taurus, the land, right? So this is your great dedication. And when I received your book, and I was like, oh, this is so perfect. Greg is right on time. He's so embraced. It's as though the bobcats and the coyotes are they're carrying your book around. They're going, have you checked this out? he published it right as Mercury goes forward, remembering what we have forgotten. There we go. And Jupiter Uranus, this Renaissance festival of guiding Earth stories. And I mentioned to you just in an email backstage just now, really, you know, the Palestinian poet, everything's connected, Rafat al-Arir, and so many poets have been murdered in Gaza. But the poet Rafat al-Arir, the voice of Gaza, and I saw a clip of a TED Talk he was giving in which he was quoting an Indian speaking to a settler, and the settler saying, "We own this land." And the Indian saying, if you feel kinned with this land, where are your stories from the land? And Rafit said, of course, the answer was silence.
So beautiful, Carolyn. Thank you for bringing that up. I saw that in your note to me, and I thought, it's absolutely true, because it is stories that connect us to the land. We only know ourselves via stories. And we only know our relationship to the land via stories of our relationship to the land. And that's basically the story of, in some ways, when you think about colonization and settler colonization, it's about people who come and impose their stories on a landscape that is already richly storied, and at the expense of what has been storied for forever. And I wanted to go back to something you said about love. And of course, last night I did a reading, in fact, at City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco. And I felt almost, Carolyn, a little...
The crows told me you did that. Okay.
Oh, did they? Okay. You heard them squawking. And by the way, there are two crows down there. I see them all the time whenever I'm not writing enough or doing something. They squawk at me. I, you know, these animals will make you feel very guilty about getting too comfortable with doing nothing. But anyway, I said something. They asked questions about, you know, what motivates you and all of that. And with this book, The Forgetters, and much of what I've done recently, I have to say love. It's been motivated by love. I feel responsible for, I don't know, the love that I've been shown, passing it on forward in these stories. Remembering, I don't want us to forget. And so, you know, it has a lot to do with love, love of the land, love of the place, with the belief and hope that we can continue.
Yes, and what's so important, and you stress this in the beauty of the, well, we're coming around to the crows, many the crow narrators of your book, The Forgetters, it's available now. And I do have to say that I finally got the hard copy. I was reading on the PDF on the computer going, and I finally got the hard copy, and it's like, oh, it's beautiful, Greg. The cover of the book is beautiful. The colors, the turquoise into the sunset.
Yeah.
Yeah, who did that? Who did that cover?
It's a new designer who was that Heyday got, and I forgot his name off the top of my head, but
okay, the crows will tell us. I'm going to hunt him down. It's
the
beautiful.
The crows will tell you sooner or later, but he worked in New York, and interestingly enough, at a big house back there, one of the big five, I believe, or I guess now it's going down to three or four, but anyway, and he came here to work at Heyday, and he's just, I mean, this book and the new issue of my former book from a couple of years ago, Becoming Story, just did beautiful, beautiful work, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, the crows are happy.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful segue from last week's show, Vision Activist Show, which I, in order to play hooky at the beach and read your book, I replayed, but it's so good. Originally recorded in 2008, interview with Janine Benyus, the founder of Biomimicry, and it could have been like yesterday. And every time I listen to it, there's more and more information. And she quoted this saying, you know, among humans, that we sang before we talked, and it's like, oh, and the crows are teaching us. And I go, oh, that's right. And in fairy tales all over, you know, and I'm thinking of another friend of the Shabbatari tonight, Gioia Timpanelli, great Sicilian storyteller, you know, who says there's five ways of traveling: walking, crawling, swimming, flying, and how we're going to travel now. Woohoo, woohoo. And I want to come back to that, because the style of storytelling that you're doing in The Forgetters, like right away, it's like, ooh, this is a dedicated style. There's a mystery here. But what Gioia says is there's two main fairy tale themes, and one is careful living in a particular place. This bobcat, this badger, this rock, this tree, right? And that's an ode to what hums in our heart that you're book really hums, you know, and then the journey and the quest to seek the treasure that one doesn't find until one returns home and stirs the coal in the hearth and goes, oh, it was here all along, but I had to go away to come back, which you did. I mean, you were born in Santa Rosa, you went away seeking the treasure in Los Angeles, and then you returned home to find the real treasure, which is kind of like one of your first stories.
It was, and you know, it's a little different from, you know, the Ulysses, where he went away, the typical Western male buildings roman, where the male goes out and, you know, goes away and then finally understands himself by going away. this is the opposite. I understood myself by coming home. Home taught mm-hmm. me, not away. And I found that even when I was away, when I was in Los Angeles, or even when I'm in New York, you know, it's a different place. It has its own stories. And I find when I'm here in the redwoods or among the trees and with the animals, it is so noisy with stories. It's noisier than being on the corner of Fifth Avenue in New York City. It's just noisy with stories, and everything's so alive because of I know the place and I'm learning the place. So I love that idea of careful living in a particular place.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I'm talking about, Carolyn.
Very much. You're talking about it, and you're invoking it. And the crows, as your quibbling narrators will introduce them. But also, it's a famous thing globally in fairy tales. One of the fairy tales, I can't remember which one, that Robert Bly would always tell. And the crows are the narrators who know the whole thing. They go, caw, caw, if the prince only knew to not drink the poisoned tea, then he would stay awake and meet his beloved. If only he could understand. Yes, the crows are carrying the narrative, if we only knew, we could avert disaster, you know, and it's really great. And you've got the crows narrating stories. So it's a classic frame story within story, which is super wonderful. But I love that and crows are very, I mean, I'm back after a week and the crows were like, hey, we've been missing the peanuts. I'm like, I'm on it. And yeah, just as you say, you know, the crows, or there's a cardinal couple that was like, wow, you were away. Now you're back. Now it's peanut time. You know, and the animals, well, this way of responding to the world, rather than in an antagonistic or polarizing way, as a guiding way. You know, when my dogs and cats and things are often like, you know, turn off the phone and come outside. I'm like, no, just one more thing. And they're like, no, really. And I go outside and it's like, oh, the moon. Thank you. I aspire to be responsible enough to live with the humans, right? So, yeah. And I was thinking of this with the richness of your book recently, too. A wonderful friend of mine, Heather Rowan Robbins, when she, great astrologer, when I visited her in Santa Fe long, long ago, and we were sitting by a tree. And she said, let me tell you about this tree. I was sitting here and there was this horsefly that just wouldn't let me alone. It wouldn't let me alone. I'm like, finally, she said, okay, I'm moving. And she moved. And within less than a minute, lightning struck that tree. And I go, right.
Oh, my goodness.
That's everything. What we think is annoying is trying to help us. All right, there we go. If we just danced with it.
Well, that we have relatives. You see, they're communicating. And if you listen... Well, it's the message of the book, and so much. If you listen, we'll live.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, to track it back and set it free, you know, it's, you know, that your book arrives and you and so glad to re-cahoot, you know, at this time, you know, it's the return of all mentors, right? And you're invoking many mentors, and the tales. Well, we'll speak a little bit about. You know, the Pomo style of storytelling, or Southern Pomo and Coast Miwok, because right from the get-go, I go, oh, this is a way of telling a story. It's a distinct texture, and is that in you? Did you learn that? And what is that?
Well, this is kind of an offshoot of a. An earlier book, How a Mountain Was Made, and that was a cycle of, you know, kind of reimagined, retold stories. But in the old days before colonization, we told stories in the winter because that's when you listen and think about stories, and in the summer you pay attention where you're going and you're living the stories, and you're, you know, busier. But one of the things, we would tell cycles of stories so that on a given night or over a period of a couple weeks of nights, you would tell one connected story to another. And they all had to do with a lot of creation stories or interconnected stories, and they would tell cycle. The old people would tell cycles of stories, and they would tell them. The storyteller, Caroline, would sit in the dark, usually on a bench or something elevated, and the people in the dark couldn't see the storyteller, and the storyteller would imitate the voices of the animals as he or she told the stories. And it was a wonderful experience for young people and others to hear and imagine these stories. And, you know, they would tell them into the night and then pick up where they left off and start a new story the next night. But the storyteller would be the person connecting one story to another. And, of course, they would, another storyteller might vary and tell the same stories in a different way at a later time, but there was always cycles of connected stories. And so that framework had a lot to do with the organizing of the book. Here, the storytellers are two crows who could also be two twin human sisters. We don't know, and it doesn't really matter. I used them. I mean, I see the two crows were always down there on the fence rail. They're probably down there now, or maybe they're on top of the house or somewhere listening to make sure I don't mess all this up with you, Caroline. But who knows?
Well, that's great. We're going to take
but anyway,
very,
that had a lot to do with it.
No, that's great. We're going to come right back in that, but we usually take a little teeny short musical break at this point. Don't go away. Don't go away. Because I found something synchronous. That's really great. I found something. It's a poem by Joy Harjo. And since it was she who first connected us with the Shabbataris, and it's like, here it is. So here's Joy Harjo reading her poem, Remember.
Okay, great.
Remember. Remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember your birth, how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life, and her mother's, and hers. Remember your father. He is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them. Listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember, you are all people, and all people are you. Remember.
There, that's Joy Harjo. That's Joy Harjo. Isn't that great, Greg?
Oh, it's amazing. I know the poem. In fact, I think that came from the collection She Had Some Horses, I think. And I remember I wrote an introduction to one to that collection. But, yeah,
it's
marvelous.
Great. Well, our self-criticism, because part of me was like, oh, if I'd prepared more, I would have found perfect break music, and I should have done more to prepare for the show with Greg because it's so wonderful and important. And then I go, let me just open this up, you know, Joy Harjo. Oh, here's a poem called Remember. Oh, this is a bit perfect, Edward. Let us remember what we've forgotten. Thank you, thank you. So it's like, even when we are not perfect, you know, we have backup. It's so great.
Right.
And then this decolonizing. I love the Thai saying that said, because we were never colonized, we never lost our animism. Right. And so this decolonizing, and, you know, it's like sort of, I heard a little bit of a TED Talk woman talking about cannabis, and a slightly grumpy questioner said, well, why do people always get silly and laugh when they smoke cannabis? And the person lecturing said, no, it's not that cannabis makes people laugh. It's that we are a laughing species. It's intrinsic to us, and it just relaxes the social inhibitions. And I love that, which is we are an animistic people intrinsically underneath all the conditioning, right? And this is what your book is so beautiful, and so much of your life and all of that, you know, is you're a grown-up and proudly animistic. Everything's alive and everything's telling us its story all the time, you know, by shape and color and song and rhythm.
I think, Caroline, sorry for interrupting, but, you know, colonization can never be complete as long as we remember.
Right.
And, you know, even if you have a page, you know, the landscape was our sacred text, and so much of it has been compromised. So many of our stories of the landscape and connection from the stories or with the stories. But as long as we have a page of that text, we can, as Joy Harjo was just saying, remember and start the connection again. And like a seed that's planted, it will sprout and grow. My experience here on the mountain has been so much of that, my coming home. So again, though so much has been in the natural world, there is no really division between an unnatural and natural world. It's all really one. But as long as no matter what has happened, colonization or death or whatever is never complete as long as there's memory. As long as there is memory and story of that connection. Once we've forgotten the stories or the connection, colonization is complete, but not until then. And we will struggle as a people, as human beings, until we accept the fact that and defeat the notion of colonization, defeat the notion that a rich, diverse story is us.
Yes, and the book, there's so many. Maybe we'll bring up Isabel and, you know, many characters if you feel to. But beautiful, beautiful. But it is as all of us read this book, and I hope we all do, The Forgetters by Greg Saris. It weds us even more to wherever we are, you know, reading and listening to some of your interviews, and going, right, I've been in my little witch's house outside D.C. for a long time, and I used to be embarrassed and that how long I've been here, because my life was not always this stable. And it's like, no, embrace that. And it's like, and I remember, you know, when there was beaver here, and I remember when there was a famous albino completely white deer, and when there was a completely white fox that used to visit. And I remember these things. They're gone now. I mean, when I moved here, I was in the woods. And I haven't moved, but the woods are gone. Although it's a 3-minute walk to the woods and to river, which is what keeps us here. You know, but it's like, right, remembering. And so much in your book is like, remember in Santa Rosa. I mean, you're placing it in Santa Rosa and Sonoma, you know, when there was a dairy here. And before the dairy, there was the wildflowers and the thing. And now even the dairy is gone. And now there's tract houses. And flying home very recently, you know, looking at tract houses. And at first I didn't know what they were. And it's like, wow, those look like really big graveyards. Oh, it's tract houses. They do. It's like graveyards. It's like there's no life. There's no thing. There's no wildlife. There's no stores. There's no mariachi bands. Back to that. But yes, remembering, you know, what was here, and then you are living in a place. Well, there's loss everywhere, isn't there? But you are living in a place where there's still bobcat, you know, and then I lived with an actual coyote for 19 years. It's my longest relationship, and a wolf dog. So these are important clues. And what I'd said to you, and again, I think your book is so like that. And we're both 1952 water dragons, so we have some things in common. So this beautiful Jupiter-Uranus conjunction, which is sort of like a nature and the ancestors trying to help the befoibled humans out, going, here are you humans. These are the two biggest path openers. It's the power of story and the power of trickster. You tell us what will help you do how, you know, and it's all of the liberating stories from the land, which is exactly what your book is. And it is full of loss and yearning, and people, it is very tender, right? Because there are befoibled people who are, let's say, well, the man who follows the osprey, thinking it leads him to treasure, right? But then in the end, he comes to himself, right? And
yeah,
it's a kind story.
Yeah, and you know, if you all of us are human beings are funny, and it makes me go back to think of, you know, the differences between our creation stories and the Judeo-Christian tradition, where their Judeo-Christian tradition is very linear, and then as a consequence, there's the great chain of being with God on top, and then man, of course, and then woman under man, and all of that sort of thing, and then kings and queens and hierarchies. Whereas in the American Indian and most indigenous creation stories, you have tricksters, coyote or crows or so forth, that are very foolish, that are much like human beings. And the earth is created as a consequence, and people are created, the world as we know it, is created as a consequence often of their foolishness, of things they had to learn. And in our tradition, Coyote was married to a frog woman, and he did some awful things that ended up, and then he got greedy and wanted to kill somebody. And this is when all the animals were people, and birds grew wings, and animals grew legs. And the human being was the one that was left the most foolish. And the human being was the one that was left who only would have stories to try to reconnect and keep connected to the human family that once all lived together. So it's our responsibility. Here we are as human beings. And all we have is stories. We can't fly. We don't have strong claws. We don't have any of that. But we have stories that can remind us and keep us connected to all the life that, say, consciousness or whatever has made us, tricks us into thinking we're separate or better than, or we can get away with certain things. So we're learning that lesson over and over again as the people in the book, the forgetters, the characters have to remember. So if that makes any sense,
Of course. It is sense and beautiful and liberating nonsense as well. They go together. That's really great. Well, in the Thousand and One Nights, right, the stories, you know, Scheherazade, whose name means city redeemer, she says, people need stories more than they need bread. And it's like, oh, that's so beautiful. Right, and when you say the Judeo-Christian story, yeah, it's kind of a bummer. But I had an Indian friend that I met on Cortez Island, and she had spent time in Africa. I can't remember exactly the place, but she'd been invited in by the local elders because they had lost their knowledge of gardening, and she came to help them remember an outsider to remember their local plants. And she said to the priest, let me get this straight. In your story, you get kicked out of the garden, right? And the priest was like, yeah. And she said, in our story, we never left the garden, so we'll help guide you back. And the priest was like, okay. Anyway, I love that. And they were good with that. So the Native American from the Pacific Northwest woman went to Africa to remind the villagers of their native plants, you know, and that we didn't need to leave the garden. We can return to it. And even the priest was like, that's a better story. Yeah. That's wonderful.
You know, people here, the Westerners or Europeans, when they came here, they referred to the wilds or to wilderness. We don't know wilderness. Wilderness or wildness happened once the landscape was no longer cared for and known. It became wild. It was no longer home. And that's the other kind of way to think about this. But I'm also thinking about what I believe it was the German philosopher Tillich who said the original sin is separation. And I think of that kind of thing, separation from one thing or another, our separations from one another, our nation separated, those kinds of things where we no longer work to affirm our similarities, our relationships to one another, and instead create enemies. It's, you know, so much of this is about getting past an us-them relationship with the world, with one another and the natural landscape, and going back to a we relationship. And I think that in my better moments, that's what I'm trying to do, and certainly trying to do in this book, reminding us of a we relationship with the world instead of an us-them. As soon as we get into an us-them kind of relationship, well, Carolyn, all hell seems to break out.
Mm-hmm. Right, tyranny feeds on polarity. It's a very tricky time because tyranny does outrageous things which cause us to go grr, 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 which tyranny feeds on, right? So again, you know, how to spiral with that. But, it's also the great Jamaican philosopher, Bunny Wailer, you know, who in the fabulous song Armageddon says, you know, in the beginning there was just we, you know, and then... Yeah. There was, you know, I and you, and that's the devil came in. Anyway. So it's everywhere. It's reggae. It's native. But that's the powerfulness of now, that Jupiter Uranus conjoining in Taurus, you know. And again, what your book is, The Forgetters by Greg Saras, you'll love it. It's liberating living stories sprung from the land and brought alive by fresh expression. You're doing great, lad. And then you're also working with the Smithsonian. I didn't know that. And on on lesson plans, yeah?
Well, one of the things is that the tribe, of all the bizarre things, Carolyn, I came up here and I, you know, co-authored the bill, as you mentioned, to get my tribe's rights back. And I tried to get it through Congress for 8 years. Long story short, President Clinton signed it on December 27th, 2000, 2 weeks before he went out of office. And we were the last, until I think rather recently, tribe to be restored by an act of Congress. But anyway, I thought, okay, I've done my work. I can go back. And then we found out the bill didn't give us a reservation or a land place again. And we tried different things. And the folks began to discuss the C word, which wasn't cancer, which is casino. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to get involved in this. But I realized that we had a lucrative location. I had a very elitist notion that, you know, casinos were very déclassé. And anyway, long story short, again, my non-Indian mother said, you can't leave your dad's people now. There's so many good examples of bad examples with casinos and so forth. So we built this thing and transformed the industry model to one where our 2,400 people all have the Kaiserco Cadillac plan who are working for us. They pay nothing out of their paychecks. They get organic produce in the team dining room. We take care of people. And we've given over in the last 10 and a half years over $100 million to charity and, you know, campaigns. We, for instance, almost gave half the financing to Proposition 1 before this last one to instill women's reproductive rights in our state constitution. So we're doing, and then co-managing agreements with the federal government for on Point Reyes National Seashore. That's 27,000 acres. So
what are you doing on Point Reyes?
We just signed about a little less than a year ago a precedent-setting, Caroline, co-management agreement with the federal government, 50-50 co-management agreement, so that all decisions about the restoration and the care for this enormous federal land, state or federal park, Point Reyes National Seashore in our Aboriginal territory here in Marin County, all decisions will be 50-50 between us and the federal government. Should there be disagreement, it goes to arbitration. So It's a wonderful position where, once again, we are positioned with the federal government to be stewards of our a home place, on the coast.
What does this mean for the elk who have been in tragic circumstances?
Thank you for asking. So, I mean, the dairies are slowly going to move out, of course, the landscape has changed radically, and we have to deal. The notion that you're going to go back to a pre-contact landscape is unrealistic and idealistic in many ways. But we have to negotiate with all of the life that's here now, so that we can once again find a way to create and work with the land for a sustainable environment and relationship for all of us. So regarding the elk, there are elk there now that have been replaced. They were, remember, totally wiped out, as was the grizzly bear, the pronghorn and the elk. But they, about 45 years ago, they introduced a small herd down there. And, of course, they're getting inbred, and they were starting to starve, and they were fenced in too small an area. So what we're going to do is we are working to restore lands, move some of the cattle out that are there in agreements with the dairymen, working with them, so that we can cut some of the fences to give the elk more room to roam. Also, what has to happen is... water. We have to make sure that, in fact, one of the things the tribe did last year with the drought is make sure that we brought in water for them. And we had to bring in, truck it in and so forth. But what we're going to also do, what needs to be done, is we need to bring in some new elk so that they aren't so inbred. They've gotten very inbred over the 40 years. So there's management that has to be done. And again, I want people to understand that indigenous people always had management practices, controlled burning and other kinds of things. And so managing the elk to some extent, given the world we find ourselves in, is necessary. And the tribe is really going to take that on and work with the federal government, with the park, to expand the elk herd as we work to maintain and enhance its health via new bloodlines and things like that.
Right, we're so relieved because they were thirsty, and people were carrying little buckets of water. And anyway,
they were also hungry. They were hungry.
No, so
we had to bring in some
feed. Terrible.
Yes.
Well, elk are pretty important. Okay, somewhere back in our first meeting notes from November of 2001, I'd scribbled on the back Vine Deloria. Vine Deloria was a great buddy of mine and a great buddy of all beings, right? But why did I put him in our notes? The segue is that when I first met Vine, he was talking and all the native people, it was at a Native Star conference, were joking about how elk is virile man medicine, and how the elk are doing is how much the virility and handsome eroticism of the men will do. So I go, it's pretty important. But did I bring up Vine Deloria because you knew him as well?
I did. I had met him, but I've since, interestingly enough, talk about segues, Carolyn. What an amazing conversation. I love talking to you. I've worked with his son. His son was on, Philip Deloria, was on the board of the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian with me. And Philip is now teaching at Harvard. And so I've worked with his son recently on the board. We have 6-year terms, and his son, I think, just got off a year ago or so. He's not on currently. But yes, a wonderful guy. These reconnections are pretty amazing.
Right. And I just want to honor Vine as a great ancestor, a great buddy, a great, the last time I saw him was he was being honored at the Library of Congress, and wait, sorry, I have to I have to silence this thing here. The modern world. The last time I saw Vine, he was being honored at the Library of Congress, and my friend Bob Goff, also an ancestor now, so many great people working with Native people. He was the lawyer for the Lakota Sioux, won the Crazy Horse lawsuit. But Bob said all the great AIM people were there. He said the only reason fistfights aren't breaking out is because Vine is here. And Vine said, I know I meet many people mythologizing themselves, and I meet many, many young activists who are very, very serious about themselves. He said, we were always serious about the issues, but always playful among ourselves. And I just wanted to throw that in, too, because your stories are playful. And Jupiter Uranus is like serious about the issues, but playful in our engagement with each other, like wolves play every 20 minutes, right? You know, we learn when we play, and you're very playful, right?
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, because there is a lot of humor in these stories, and a lot of the things we do as human beings and the stories we tell about one another are laughable and laughing.
Right. Well, and also your stories are very kind, right? There is the Chilean man, because the crows are like, tell a story about somebody who's not a native. You know, okay, all right, we will. The Chilean man, and you know, who's a braggart, a braggadocio, and a faux person, and a kind of a con, but he becomes a real and beautiful person in the story.
And,
you know, these are stories of change.
Carolyn. Yeah, and Carolyn. Underneath the braggadocio, that's the humanity, a person bragging, a person saying those kinds of things. What the person is really saying, if we stop and stand back and don't react to the braggadocio, is the person has a real need, an overbearing need, we might say, to say, I'm here, see me, I want to be loved, I want to be recognized. And that's what all of the people come to see in him at the end, and hence love and appreciate him, and remember, of course, the meadowlark that was the conduit to that understanding.
There's a lot of birds, a lot of crucial birds in these stories where we're on our way out all too soon, but I'm very glad to be re-cahooting Greg Saris. You know, there's a million more things to talk about and to spiral forth to let people know about the good works you're engaged in and cahooting, and we will do that. Greg Saris's book, The Forgetters, is super wonderful and available now at this timely time of Jupiter-Uranus stories from the land. May we all be kind. Thank you so much, Greg Saris.
Carolyn, I can't thank you enough. Thank you for caring.
Oh, of course. Of course. Woof, 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 woof. All right, more at some perfect time. There we go. And Kirsten Thomas, always wonderful board up. Thank you. Okay, team, we will reconvene next week. Coyote Network News, the show on Patreon. Woof, bye.